unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up to the lust of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to their dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and received honor in themselves, the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manners of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them.
Good morning. Habakkuk 2:20 says, "But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him." Psalm 95 begins, "O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation." What's the difference in those two passages, Habakkuk chapter 2 and the 95th Psalm? One is telling us to keep silence before the Lord. He's in his temple, the temple we associate with worship, with the presence of the Lord. The presence of the Lord should be a glad thing. Why is all the earth supposed to keep silent in the one? But here in Psalm 95, we're encouraged to make a joyful shout, to sing. Context, as in many areas, is so important here. In Habakkuk chapter 2, he's talking about idolatry and how the world has gone that direction. And what is idolatry? When you boil idolatry down, what is it but the worship of self? Yes, you may build a thing of wood or stone or cast it in gold or silver, but you're worshiping sensual things, things that gratify you. God is saying, come out from that. All the earth, come out from that. Because when you boil it down, that's what all the earth worships. Come out from that and recognize God. And that's why they have to keep their silence at that point. There's a recognition and a respect that God is due at that point. God's asking them to consider their Creator. In Psalm 95, the situation is a little bit reversed, because here we're talking about the children of God who have already been pulled from that and made a covenant relationship with Him. They're already distinct, special, chosen in particular. They know the difference now. God has shown them. God's given them law by which they understand His will and His standards. That's special. They understand how precious that is. So they understand that their relationship with God is different than everybody else's. That God's giving them things that He's not giving anybody else. And that is cause for rejoicing. So there's two different sets of people talked about in these two passages. I'd like to continue in Psalm 95 for just a moment. "Oh, come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before His presence with thanksgiving. Let us shout joyfully to him with psalms, for the Lord is the great God and the great King above all gods. In his hands are the deep places of the earth. The heights of the hills are also his. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. O come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God. We are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. Today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the day of rebellion, as in the day of trial in the wilderness when your fathers tested me. Israel had gone astray at times when they were pulled out of Egypt during the times of the Exodus and the wanderings. And they tested God, and God proved his faithfulness to his covenant, didn't he? They made a covenant with God, and he said, if you don't do the things I expect of you, then I am going to punish you for that. God says later in 10th verse of Psalm 95, for 40 years I was grieved with that generation. It grieves God when we rebel. It grieves him. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. There are two things in this psalm and elsewhere that we're going to look at that are of the utmost importance, and they were touched upon in the reading that Chris made for us in the first chapter of Romans. God is the creator. That gives him rights, doesn't it? That gives him rights. And as it's been explained before to us, it's okay to be jealous for things that are due to you. And so God would ask all the earth, and he would ask especially his own people, his children, where is my honor? It's mine by right. God is our creator. And that gives him the right to judge, and that's the second thing. Hop down to Psalm 96, much the same. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Proclaim the good news of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his wonders among all the peoples. For the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of the people are idols. But the Lord made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. Give to the Lord, O families of the peoples. Give to the Lord glory and strength. Give to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. O worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. The world also is firmly established. It shall not be moved. He shall judge the peoples righteously. Let the heavens rejoice and let the earth be glad. Let the sea roar in all its fullness. Let the field be joyful and all that is in it. Then all the trees of the woods will rejoice before the Lord, for he is coming. For he is coming to judge the earth. He shall judge the world with righteousness and the peoples in his truth. He is the creator and he is the judge. We just celebrate a memorial where Jesus asked us to remember. And I guess I would title this lesson, Lest We Forget. When you read Job, it's an interesting book. We all know the story of Job well, what he lost in a single day, a trial that I would not wish on my worst enemy had I won. And we know that as the conversation with his friends progresses, Job may get a little on his high horse a little bit. So God comes down in a whirlwind, and he asks Job a series of 84 questions. But it's really only one question. Anybody want to take a stab at what that question really is? Who do you think I am? Who do you think I am? Where were you, Job, when I laid the foundations of the earth? Where were you when I set the seas in their place and told it that this is where you can come? Your proud ways can come this far, but no further. Where were you when I set the stars in their courses? Where were you? Job can, of course, answer none of those questions. But God is just reminding Job who he is and his position relative to Job. And it's a good reminder for all of us to consider. But in all of those places and more, which we'll take another look at, it's God as the creator that is the foundation of his arguments. And I've always thought that was interesting. I think that's actually good, because that's a good place to start when we're talking with people who have never been in a covenant relationship with God. That the earth is the Lord's in all of its fullness. He created every last stick. Everything that has life on this earth was given by God. So the creation is a good place to start, isn't it? And it's by the fact that he is the creator that he is also the judge. Psalm 98. O sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have gained him the victory. The Lord has made known his salvation. His righteousness he has revealed in the sight of the nations. He has remembered his mercy and his faithfulness to the house of Israel. All the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. Shout joyfully to the Lord, all the earth. Break forth in song, rejoice, and sing praises. Sing to the Lord with the harp and the sound of a psalm, with trumpets and the sound of a horn. Shout joyfully before the Lord the King. Let the sea roar in all its fullness, the world and those who dwell in it. Let the rivers clap their hands. Let the hills be joyful together before the Lord, for he is coming to judge the earth. With righteousness he shall judge. And you and I are so much like the Israelites. Our journey mirrors those in so many ways. So it's always a good reminder for us to take heed of the lessons of the Old Testament, which is why the series on the minor on the prophets actually has been so beneficial to us, I think. Lest we forget. Who is God? Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 40. We'll spend a little bit of time here. Time that we didn't get to spend in the class on Isaiah that we did. But God touches on all these themes, all of these themes. And a little bit goes into a little bit more detail than what I've gone into. But it kind of served as the overall outline of this lesson this morning. So I thought we would spend some time here. In the first 39 chapters, which some people like to dub the judgment chapters, and in many ways that's very true, chapter 40 begins what some people call the blessings part of the book. And that's also very true, but I think it's interesting that the blessings start off with a very serious warning and reminder of who God is, but he gives us a teaspoon of sugar first with the first verse here. Comfort. Yes, comfort my people, says your God. Speak comfort to Jerusalem and cry out to her. That her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned. For she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill brought low. The crooked places shall be made straight. And the rough places smooth. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. The voice said, cry out. And he said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, because the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. O Zion, you who bring good tidings, get up into the high mountains, O Jerusalem. You who bring good tidings. Lift up your voice with strength. Lift it up, be not afraid. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord God shall come with a strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom. And gently lead those who are with young. I promise that the Lord is going to send a shepherd. God looks at his people Israel and has for a long time, with much long suffering and endurance on his part, looked down and seen a wayward people, a stiff-necked, rebellious people. Yet God continued to love them. And God continued to keep his promises. God is not slack concerning his promises, as some count slackness. He loves keeping his word. And it would have been a joy to him, but he to some extent had to do so regretfully in the case of the Israelites. But he loved Abraham, and he had made a promise to Abraham. He loved David, and God had made a promise to David. So God was going to keep his word. And in spite of all of Israel's malfeasance, he was going to continue with his promises and give them a shepherd from the line of David. And he was going to be the source of this great comfort. And in verse 6, God gives us a reminder of the difference between him and God, us and God. See, God sees us like grass. Grass is a very tender, delicate thing. I can go out and stomp on it. There's a yard that I spent a lot of time in the last week, and I was taking a vehicle in and out of the gate in their backyard. And in the course of doing work back there, I had the wheels of that vehicle trampled in the entire backyard. All the grass was just laying down flat, even after a couple days of sunlight. Just laying down. God can blow on the grass and it just withers and dies. And that's the same with us. He's going to say that later about princes and nations. He can just blow on them and they wither and die. That's the difference between God and us. All flesh is as grass, but his word is what stands forever. Peter quoted this passage in 1 Peter chapter 1. He says, it's by this word that you were reborn. It's by this word that you were reborn. So as your flesh withers and dies, which it eventually will, God's word and his promises to you are going to stand forever. And that's what separates God from everybody else you've had dealings with. You've been lied to. You've been betrayed. You've been stabbed in the back. God is never going to do that to you. Once he makes a deal, that's it. About 10 years ago, in a professional situation, I learned the hard way that there are not enough gentlemen left to make gentlemen's agreements worth anything. I imagine maybe some of you have had a similar experience. But God is not a man that he should lie. So when God promises something, it's as good as done. Verse 10, the Lord's going to come with a strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. And that arm is, of course, Jesus Christ, the shepherd, and the arm of the Lord's deliverance for his people. Then in verse 12, he switches modes again. I shouldn't say switches mode, but he gives us another piece of information that's worthwhile. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? Measured heaven with a span. And calculated the dust of the earth in a measure. These are all very similar questions to what Job was getting. Weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or as his counselor has taught him. With whom did he take counsel? And who instructed him and taught him in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? God, his thoughts are not our thoughts. Neither are his ways our ways. There's such a gulf between God and us, and it's hard for us to fathom sometimes. Have you ever wondered why God went to all this trouble? Why create the earth in the first place? Why go through all that grief on his part, watching people that he loves and created? Why watch them rebel over and over again? I think the answer lies in the fact that God is love. God wants to show someone his love. And I don't think that's much different than any parent, any couple that wants to have children and raise children together. It's an act of love. Verse 15, behold, the nations are as a drop in a bucket and are counted as the small dust on the scales. Look, he lifts up the isles as a very little thing. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beasts sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted by him less than nothing and worthless. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare to him? The workman molds an image, the goldsmith overspreads it with gold, and the silversmith casts silver chains. Whoever is too impoverished for such a contribution chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks for himself a skillful workman to prepare a carved image that will not totter. God is incomparable, is what these verses are telling us. There's nothing on this earth that compares to God. We think in terms of great nations and powerful nations. And usually when we do so, we're thinking one of two things, and usually they both go together, as economic power and wealth. Has there ever been anything that defines America more than those two things? Economic power and military power is what I meant to say. Wealth and military power. No nation has ever been as powerful as us. I was reading a book, actually a couple books by one author, and it was kind of interesting. He said that, you know, as Americans, we don't really appreciate just how powerful we are. You know, when America rattles its sabers, the world shakes. The world is scared to death of what we might do. We don't understand how the balance of power works. We don't appreciate it, how the balance of power works in this world. And yet, God counts America as nothing, and less than nothing. As less than nothing. Nothing and worthless. A nation is not comparable to God. If he can measure the waters in the hollow of his hand and the heavens with a span, what can he do to America? And what can he do to you is the question that needs to be on all of our minds. God is not like any nation. He's also not like any nation's idols. People will set themselves up idols and they'll worship him, but they, like I said earlier, they all boil down to one thing, and that is, I want to worship myself. I want to worship something that gratifies me, that allows me to gratify myself. And that's really all idolatry ever has been. It's worshiping yourself. Verse 21, have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? What did man know in the beginning? Going back to our reading from Romans chapter 1, what did man know in the beginning? The answer is, they knew God. Everybody knew God at one point. And when you read Romans chapter 1, as Chris went through that with us, what do you see but a willful decision on all men's part to reject the knowledge of the truth of God? Purposefully. Now, how do you do that? I don't really know. How have I done it? That I do know. I know how deceitful things in this world can be. I know how easy it is to get tricked. You've heard the expression, there's a sucker born every minute. I was one of those suckers. And so were you. We're all suckers for something. We're all suckers for something. The nations knew God and chose to reject him. Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted, scarcely shall they be sown. Scarcely shall their stock take root in the earth, when he will also blow on them, and they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. To whom will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal? Says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high, and see who has created these things, who brings out their hosts by number. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one is missing. I haven't spent a whole time looking at astronomical data or anything like that. I do like those coffee table books where the Hubble Space Telescope took pictures of deep space and things like that. I think that stuff is awesome. I've gone through some of that. And we've tried to give them names. Now, we can't even see all of the stars out there. But we've run out of names. A lot of them have names like EA21850-X. God has a real name for all of them. Can you imagine that? The human languages, all of them combined, would have run out of names for these things. But God has called them all by name, and not one is missing. He says, lift up your eyes and consider your Maker. Consider who created these things and the fact that he knows them all. And that tells us that he knows us too. And he knows everything about us. Verse 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary? His understanding is unsearchable. His understanding is unsearchable. God doesn't get tired of keeping an eye on us. God doesn't get tired of keeping an eye on the sparrow. And how much more value are you than a sparrow? God is going to judge. God is the judge of the earth. He has appointed each man to die once, and after this, the judgment. Each to die once, and after this, the judgment. Every secret thing, every hidden thing is going to be brought to light because he knows. God watched it and God witnessed it. We speak of God as being omnipresent, which means everywhere all at once, but you think about that, omnipresent. Doesn't that include everywhere at all times? Everywhere at all times. We're told that God sees the end from the beginning. That's because God is already at the end. And he's always at the beginning. And everywhere in between, I think God can experience it or does experience all time at the same time. He's already seen all the possibilities, but he knows which direction you're going to go. So everything you've ever done, he has a record of it. He sees every secret thing, and not one thing is hidden from his view. My way is hidden from the Lord, and that's the talk of a fool who does not recognize his Creator and is not considering his ways. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. This was mentioned earlier in some of the Psalms and in this passage as well, that God's judgment, when he judges, is going to be righteous judgment. And it's so easy to get caught up today, especially in conversation with people. Well, how's he going to judge this? You know, norms and morals and all those things, they're changing. A lot of them are getting reversed and tossed upside down. Woe to those who call good evil and evil good, who exchange sweet for bitter and bitter for sweet. That's happening in our society today. And so one of the things that's going to be a non-starter for a lot of people is what you and I consider common biblical morality. And judging people, not and being intolerant and things like that. Do you think the nations are being deceived right now? In the book of Revelation, it talks about a short season where Satan will be unbound for a short season so that he can deceive the nations. And just in my personal opinion, if Satan is not deceiving the nations as we speak, then someone is. Then someone is. When we see the things that we're seeing worldwide, the UN and America and the Human Rights Council and all these things doing things that are opposed to God, I can't help but think that the nations are being deceived. And to them, of course, his understanding is unsearchable. Verse 29, he gives power to the weak, and those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall not faint. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. You remember in 2 Corinthians, Paul spoke of a messenger of Satan, a thorn in the flesh to buffet me. Three times he asked God to remove that thorn. And actually he asked the Lord. And what was Jesus' response? What did Jesus say? Someone answer that. My grace is sufficient. And? My strength is perfected in weakness. How can that be? You know, there's some, I don't know if I should call it debate, speculation, that's a better word. There's some speculation about what that thorn in the flesh of Paul might be. Some have considered it might be something with his eyes. But you know, in that passage, he's actually talking about giving oracles and speaking. And he, one of the things that he told the Corinthians, or he relayed a consensus, I guess, concerning himself, was that his speech was contemptible. You remember when he wrote that? His bodily presence was weak and his speech is contemptible. What if Paul had a speech impediment of some sort? Just throwing that out there. But whatever it was, Paul, in Paul's view, it hindered his service to God. And he needed it removed. He needed it gone away. And then he could do great things for God, or greater, more powerful. But Jesus was like, nah. Because Jesus was getting the acceptable service from Paul already. And he was getting that in spite of the weakness. And that glorifies God. When we're doing things that are beyond us to some extent, because of our faith, or something that is uncommon to other people because we're willing to persevere and wait on our Lord, that's when God is viewed differently in the eyes of the world. That's when His strength is perfected in our weakness. When everybody else would give up and be weary, we continue persevering in well-doing. They shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not be faint. God makes distinctions between peoples. And He always had. From the early chapters of Genesis, we hear about the sons of God and the daughters of men. The differences there are probably a lot like what we read about in Romans chapter 1. Some had chosen to stick with God, and some had chosen to follow idols or whatever. They were rejecting God to some degree. And ever since that time, there's always been people dedicated to God, a remnant, who are willing to give themselves to Him and stick with Him. Even if it was just numbered in the few thousands, that has always been the case. And to those people were always special to God. Always different, particular. And so God looked at the vast mass of humanity and He chose one man from among all those people, Abraham. He revealed Himself to Abraham, who, as we read about from the book of Joshua, was an idolater himself. That's an interesting thing to consider, isn't it? When you read the book of Joshua, chapter 24, Joshua admits that our people, when they lived on the other side of the river, that being the river Euphrates, were idolaters. Yet God called Abraham, and Abraham left those idols behind, physically and literally. And that made him special. That made him different. That made him distinct. And we know the story from there. We know the story of Jacob and Joseph, Moses and Joshua, all that work God did to pull those people out of that bondage and make them special and distinct. They wandered around for 40 years because God was grieved at their rebellion. But then on a day, they're on the east side of the Jordan on a plateau. They're looking down on one morning into the Jordan Valley. And you have to imagine the scene. The Jordan Valley, the place where they crossed, is right before you get to the Dead Sea, the lowest point on terrestrial earth. So as the sun rose behind them in the east, they were looking down into a valley of the shadow of death. Because that's what the Jordan symbolizes, isn't it? It's a valley of the shadow of death. And the covenant that God made with the Israelites made a distinction between the priests and the people. They weren't to mix. At least their responsibilities. The priests were distinct from the people. So you have to imagine you're one of the people and you're looking into this valley of the shadow of death, and you hear an instruction and you're very thankful for it because you're told to wait and follow no closer than 2,000 cubits behind while the priests make their way down off this plateau into this valley because they have not gone this way before. Now, as the priests are descending into this relative gloom, what's going to help the people out? You ever thought about that? Two things. What are the priests wearing? Sparkling white robes. And what are they carrying? The Ark of the Covenant, upon which rests a glittering golden mercy seat. From all the gloom of the world, you see this one light, one spot of brightness, distinct from the rest, distinct from the surroundings, different. A people that recognizes their Creator, and a people that has come to the conclusion that they are going to be judged every secret thing. And what they want is a different destiny than those who continually rebel. That's our lesson for this morning. I hope you found something worthwhile in it. One thing that's always worthwhile is to consider our relationship with God, to consider our standing with Him, to consider whether or not we are indeed in the faith. Some of us may have made a commitment to God but have strayed. Some of us may have never made that commitment. We invite you to change your situation by coming forward as we stand and sing the number that Shane has selected.